This is the 2010 West Coast School of the Prophets. We've been looking at the theme, the prophecy of Ezekiel 38, with our brother Roger Lewis. This is session number 7, the framework of Bible prophecy, part 2. Brother Roger.
Well, last night we started this review of the framework of Bible prophecy because we suggested that it would be helpful as part of the bigger picture into which Ezekiel 38 comes as a contextual setting. And I just want to go back to where we started last night. We reminded ourselves that this is the continuous theme of Scripture, the story of the seed of the woman versus the seed of the serpent down through time. Again, as an aside, we did a very profitable Schools of the Prophets on just this one idea, and traced that through. What we did is we each took a chunk of the Bible. So someone took the books of the law of Moses, the first 5 books. Someone took the book of Kings. Someone took the poetical books. Someone took the prophecies. Someone took the gospels. Another group took the epistles. And we just did, we worked through every reference we could come across to the two seeds in conflict with one another. And it's just astonishing how much material we gathered that in fact is centered on this theme. So that would be another good line of research. Now, remember how we said that those two seeds, very quickly on in the history of mankind, formed two groups that came to be known effectively as Babylon versus Israel. In some cases, Babylon versus Jerusalem. But Babylon versus Jerusalem are titles about two cities, aren't they? Rival cities, Babylon versus Jerusalem. Whereas Babylon versus Israel is the same controversy expanded to be between two nations, two whole communities of people. And so for purposes of our exercise, we've talked about Babylon versus Israel. And one of the things we mentioned was that we believe there were two phases or stages to that conflict. There's an Old Testament phase where the seed of the serpent is seen to be in conflict with the seed of the woman, and we've got a Babylon versus Israel in the Old Testament. But likewise, in the New Testament, we're going to have a seed of the woman phase that will effectively be the Babylon of that era, and there'll be an Israel phase in the New Testament. And it's really those phases that we want to just speak about a little bit more tonight in terms of our second session. Now, why this is useful and helpful is because we want to keep reminding ourselves that Ezekiel 38 fits into this somehow. It might be about Gog, it might be about the latter-day Scythian, it might be about a military invasion, but what's the controversy down through time? Babylon versus Israel. So somewhere this has got still to do with Babylon. It just may be that it's the military aspect of Babylon as opposed to the political aspect or the religious aspect, but somewhere it's on the Babylonian line. It's a red line prophecy in that sense. So what I want to do tonight is just to work through the detail of the transition a bit more thoroughly, because you might think that that's right, but it's mere assertion at this stage, isn't it? Can we prove that a little more profoundly from biblical analysis? Remember, we reminded ourselves, someone's already told me there's a typo on this one, so God's purpose was marked out by two great stages on either side of Christ's first advent. The period of the changeover pivots on the manifestation of the true seed of the woman singular, not woman plural, the true seed of the woman, of course, of Genesis 3:15. So Christ comes, as it were, in the middle. Of course, you realise that if this is 6,000 years, Christ didn't actually come in the middle of the 6,000 years, because he didn't come at year 3,000. He came at about year 4,000. But this is not supposed to be an exactly time sequence accurate picture. The bump in the middle is simply to keep the thing proportionate, mainly so we can fit text in, actually. If we put the bump at the right chronological moment, I couldn't fit all my words in. So just realise that the bump is not intended to be time accurate. But there's a bump in the middle because there's a changeover, as it were, at that particular time. And maybe another reason why there are those two stages is this, that when you stop and think about the promise of Genesis 3:15, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed, and I'm reversing the order now, thou shalt bruise his heel, and he shall bruise thy head. That's the essence of Genesis 3:15, isn't it? In the actual order in which it will occur. So isn't that really the stages? I'll put enmity between the woman, thee and the woman, starts right at the start. Halfway through the story, or partway through the story, thou shalt bruise his heel. And at the end of the story, he shall bruise thy head. So that's the sequence of Bible prophecy, isn't it? Based on Genesis 3:15. The enmity starts there. This is the first great moment in the controversy, where the seed of the serpent momentarily triumphs over the seed of the woman, but it leads to this final triumph of the blue line community at the time of the end, when Christ vanquishes the serpent power once and for all. And when you put the simple terminology of Genesis 3:15 on the top of that little chart, it all seems to make sense, doesn't it? That essentially follows the sequence of perhaps why Bible prophecy is structured that way. So tonight we're going to trace that in a little bit more detail. In fact, what I'm going to suggest is this. You may not have stopped to think about this before, but it's a very, very good thought. What's the great prophecy of the Old Testament? Book of Daniel. Look, I know there's others, but it's probably the most substantive prophecy of the Old Testament era. What's the great prophecy of the New Testament? I accept that. Book of Revelation. I think that's correct. There's a prophecy in the middle. The prophecy in the middle is the Olivet prophecy of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, what's interesting about those prophecies is that you'll find that Christ quotes from Daniel in the Olivet prophecy. And the Olivet prophecy turns up in the prophecy of John in the book of Revelation. Now, I think you've got a sequence of thought here, because if you stop and think about the red line versus the blue line, what was the great tragedy of the Old Testament era? What was the greatest tragedy of the Old Testament era? Anyone like to exile. Suggest what it was? The exile? By whom and into where? Sorry? By God, who exiled the blue line, the children of Israel, into Babylon. Babylon, the red line, the seed of the serpent power. He took them there. They came under the dominating influence of the red line, the seed of the serpent power, in the form of Babylon. What's the book of Revelation all about as it comes to its climax? The destruction of mystical Babylon and the final triumph of Israel. What's the Olivet prophecy all about? It's about the overthrow of the blue line by Rome. And I can assure you, because that's what we're going to look at tonight, is that Rome is a continuation of the Babylonian system. And the Lord's bridging prophecy, if I can call it that, the Olivet prophecy stands as the bridge, the connection between the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. And there's going to be three great episodes down the line of the prophetical structure where the seed of the serpent power will, as it were, triumph. The Babylonian captivity, the Roman invasion, the Babylonian catastrophe at the time of the end. These are the three great epochs of the seed of the serpent power triumphing over the seed of the woman in successive moments of history. And there's a prophecy that covers each of those moments. Isn't that interesting? So you see how it's very helpful to have a big picture view, as well as looking at something more microscopic, such as Ezekiel 38, to always have this wider perspective of the framework of Bible prophecy, because it makes such tremendous sense. It helps to keep everything strongly in a wider overall context. So what we're going to do tonight is to actually suggest this. Here we've got an interesting chart that says the blue line comes down here and stops, but in fact it sort of restarts again on a second line, and you notice that the second blue line commences before the first blue line terminates. And likewise with the red line terminates here, but before that red line terminates, another red line has already begun. So what I'm really saying, of course, is that the Babylon of the Old Testament era stopped at some stage. Historically, it finished. But before that system finished, a new Babylon had already begun and emerged that would carry on the Babylonian system and carry on the conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And likewise, Israel was going to end in AD 70, was it not? But before AD 70 came, a new Israel had already been formed and the line would carry on. So let's just see how that worked. Interesting, really, because Israel phase one ends in AD 70. Think we'd all accept that? Happy with that? Okay, what's interesting is that 40 years before that, Israel phase two began, approximately AD 30, with the formation of the ecclesia in the time of Pentecost, after the resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. The ecclesia of Acts chapter 1 is going to be an Israel of the New Testament epoch. And so there's going to be another blue line has begun in AD 30, about 40 years before Israel phase 1 comes to an end in AD 70. A blue line's going to carry on. It's not going to be the nation of Israel anymore. They're going to be cast off into captivity. They're going to disappear off the face of the land of Israel. But the blue line, see the woman community, is going to carry on. And in a sense, they will take the name Israel as a proxy term. Now, the interesting thing is that that's exactly what was going to happen with Babylon. Because Babylon phase 1 ended approximately BC 293. There's some debate about that, but essentially the ancient Babylonian system was deemed to be pretty much finished by BC 293. As a power, as an empire, as an entity, it was finished. But it just so happens, surprise, surprise, that about 40 years before that, Babylon phase 2 had already begun. So that the seed of the serpent power would also continue, as well as this conflict down through time. And not only would the conflict change in terms of who Babylon would be and who Israel would be, but the scene of the controversy would change. Because the controversy of Babylon phase 1 versus Israel phase 1 was going to be played out in the land of promise, wasn't it, in Israel? But the great controversy of Babylon phase 2 versus Israel phase 2 wasn't going to be played out in the land of Israel. It was going to be played out in other places and principally in Europe as the seed of the woman community spread abroad and actually left Israel and travelled into other parts with the preaching of the gospel. The scene of that conflict was going to geographically alter to another location. So let me show you historically how this works its way out. I want to start with the Israel side, because we think we know it, but I think it's good to have a biblical imperative. So when did Israel 1 become Israel 2? When did Israel phase 1 become Israel phase 2? And what's the biblical basis for that? Well, the first thing is, you might like to come to Luke chapter 21, because there's an interesting comment in Luke 21. You may not have read this passage this way. I guess there could be even some debate about whether it means this, but I rather think that there is an indication of this. That the time of transition from Israel phase 1 to Israel phase 2 occurred at the time of the manifestation of the true seed of the woman, and that one of the works of Christ, we're told, was to reach out to the Gentiles. We're told that in Isaiah 49, he was going to reach out to be a light to the Gentiles, and that the involvement of the Gentiles would come at the very epoch of the overthrow of Israel phase 1. Do you remember how Joel 2 said, didn't Joel 2 prophesy that when there was blood and fire and pillars of smoke, that upon your sons and daughters I will pour out the Spirit and they shall prophesy, and it shall come to pass in that time, that whosoever shall call upon the name of Yahweh shall be saved. And the promise of Joel 2 was that at the very epoch of AD 70, as the Jewish Commonwealth was being overthrown, that a time of opportunity would emerge for the Gentiles to also hear the truth and be embraced into the covenant promises. Now, you notice what Luke 21 says, verse 23. Woe to them that are with child, to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, of course, ordinarily we read the word times of the Gentiles as being the times of Gentiles' domination. The time of Gentile domination over Israel. And so it might be. But the interesting thing is that the word time here, or times, in Luke 21:24, is not the Greek word chronos, which means a specific interval of time. It's the word kairos in the Greek, which means a season of time, the season of the Gentiles. But the question is, what was that season of the Gentiles all about? Was it the season of the Gentiles to dominate Israel, or was there a season of some other opportunity as well? And the answer is, well, let me just check a couple of references in my Bible here. Oh, a couple of cross-references for that word, by the way. Mark 12, verse 2, at that season he sent to the husbandman a servant. I presume that that word season, because I've got it down here, is probably the word times here, the word kairos. It's also the word in Acts 1, verse 7, it is not for you to know the times and the seasons, the kairoses, the seasons. But what's also interesting is that that word kairos in Galatians 6, verse 10, and Hebrews 11, verse 15, is translated as not season, but opportunity. Galatians 6, verse 10, as you have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, as you have seasons, kairoses, as you've got times, opportunities. And Hebrews 11, verse 15, anyone quote Hebrews 11, verse 15 to me from memory? And truly they would have had opportunity to have returned to that country from whence they came. They would have had a kairos, a season of opportunity. So I think that one of the meanings of the word kairos is opportunity. Not just a season, but a time of opportunity. Now what would the time of the opportunity of the Gentiles be? At the very time that Israel phase one is coming to an end, it wasn't just that there were going to be some Gentiles that would dominate the Israeli people, but some Gentiles would find that there was a season of opportunity opening up for them to come to a knowledge of the truth until the opportunity of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, opportunity of the Gentiles, times of the Gentiles, until the time be fulfilled. What Bible echo does that give you? What other Bible passage springs to mind? That's got to be Romans 11, doesn't it? So doesn't Romans 11 say, which is up there, doesn't Romans 11 say that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be brought in, and so all Israel shall be saved? And so there was a season of opportunity that began for the Gentiles to come into the knowledge of the truth. And when did that happen? At the very same time as the overthrow of the Jewish Commonwealth. The Olivet prophecy of Luke 21 said, just at the same time that Israel was going to come to an end, an opportunity was going to open up for the fullness of the Gentiles to be brought in to the saving knowledge of the gospel. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and we won't turn this one up, but Revelation 7 talks about the spread of the truth in the New Testament era. It says that angels go forth to seal the nations. The strange thing is that the nations that they seal, Gentiles, are described as the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. They're actually Gentiles. Revelation chapter 7. Multitude of the Gentiles to whom the truth come, but for some peculiar reason they're described as the children of Israel. Well, maybe it's not peculiar, because I think they're deliberately called that because the community of the Gentiles that come into the truth in New Testament times are the Israel phase 2 of the New Testament era, you see. Here's another line of reasoning that goes with that, is that the community of Gentile believers are considered to be part of the Commonwealth of Israel, aren't they? Ephesians 2. Now you're no longer strangers and foreigners, but citizens with the saints, members of the Commonwealth of Israel. And doesn't Paul in Galatians 6, verse 16, in writing to the Gentiles, calls them the Israel of God? Galatians 6, 16. Gentile believers, he calls the Israel of God. So, oh yes, I think there's an Israel of the New Testament era, but it's not Jewish people in the land. It's believers of the truth that are going to live in other parts, other places. And yet they're still Israel, and perhaps more importantly, they're still part of the seed of the woman community. Well, here's perhaps the most compelling one of all, and that's this one. Do you remember how in Exodus 19, God calls the nation to himself, to Sinai, and he says that if you obey my voice indeed, you shall be unto me a peculiar people, a kingdom of priests, and an holy nation. And yet when you come to the first epistle of Peter, chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, he says, "But unto you which believe, he is precious. God's called you to be an holy people, a peculiar people, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation." He quotes all the words out of, why, Exodus chapter 19 about Israel phase 1, and says, "You're the Israel phase 2." He uses all the same language. And the only reason he uses the same language to describe the believers of the New Testament era is because clearly they're considered to be Israel phase 2. So the seed of the woman community moves to another era, as it were, in the New Testament epoch of time. And the Israel of the Old Testament finds that it is wonderfully and marvelously superseded by an Israel of the New Testament, because in fact what's going to happen is the seed of the woman is going to continue down through time. Now, I just want to mention that I think that that's actually something that was implied right from the beginning of biblical times. So just, we won't turn this up, but just go back in your thinking. Now, if I just turn that off for a moment. So imagine what happens. Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. Abel turns out to be the righteous seed, but he's murdered. Cain is exiled. Seth is born. God's appointed me another seed, the seed of the woman. And sure enough, Seth's offspring turn out to be godly people who call upon the name of the Lord. Do you think God was with Seth? Yes. Do you think God was with Enoch? Yes. Do you think God was with Methuselah? Noah? Yes. Shem? Yes. So do you know that that span of time, in fact, going, and of course Shem takes us through from Genesis 11 to Genesis 12, we come to Abraham. Do you know that span of time from Adam to Abraham is 2,000 years? There's no nation of Israel. For 2,000 years, there's been the seed of the woman, but no nation of Israel. But God's purpose has been at work, hasn't it? All the way down through that time, the controversy of the two seeds has been at work, and the seed of the woman has been there. In fact, you know what I believe? I believe that Noah probably died in Salem, where Shem was, his son, probably wondering how God would nourish the seed of the woman. Noah might have died not knowing what was going to happen. But the interesting thing is that even though there's a span of several generations that separate the two, I think that Abraham, through whom the next great advance of the seed of the woman community is going to be taken, I think Abraham meets Shem, doesn't he? And there's an exchange. So the seed of the woman community carries on. And I think it was in the providence of God that that meeting take place. Shem was the great inheritor of the seed of the woman community. He was the priest of the seed of the woman. In the tent of Shem was the prophecy of Noah. You want to find fellowship with God, you've got to come to the tent of Shem. Well, I think Abraham came to the tent of Shem in Salem and met him there. And that line was carried on, you see. Now, when Abraham receives a promise, he's told this. We won't turn it up, but in Genesis 17, God says to him, "I'm God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply." Where do you think that comes from? Promise to Abraham, be fruitful and multiply. Comes from Noah. Really? You're absolutely right. Where does it come from in Noah's day? Comes from Genesis chapter 1 to Adam and Eve. Be fruitful and multiply. So the promise to Abraham, be fruitful and multiply, is the old request, the old command to the seed of the woman right back at the beginning of time. And not only is that the case, but in the context of being fruitful and multiplying to Abraham, do you know what God says in Genesis 17? He says, "For I will make thee a father of many..." Now, what's the Hebrew word for nations? It's the word goyim. Do you know what goyim is?
Gentiles.
It's the Jewish word for Gentiles. "I will make thee a father of many Gentiles." Implicit in the promise of Abraham right from the beginning is that this promise was not exclusively linked or devoted or restricted to just Israel as a nation. The seed of the woman community is far too important to be restricted to just Jewish people. "I'll make thee a father of many goyim" is the promise to Abraham. And right down through time, that promise is going to occur. Isn't there going to be a Caleb? Isn't there going to be a Rahab? Isn't there going to be a Ruth? Aren't there going to be Kenites? Aren't there going to be Nethinim? All the way down through the history, even of Jewish times, there's going to be non-Jews. There's going to be Gentiles incorporated in that seed of the woman line down through time, as if to underscore the fact that right from the beginning it was anticipated that thus it would be so. So that when we come to the New Testament, we suddenly find that Israel as a nation is cast off, but the blue line carries on. That all seems, well, absolutely appropriate, doesn't it? Why would God allow the blue line of the seed of the woman community who manifests his name, why would he allow that line to be extinguished in the earth merely because his nation was cast off because of unbelief? He didn't. He couldn't. The blue line carries on. Why? Because the conflict is endless until one party triumphs over the other. That conflict never ceases. So Israel phase one becomes Israel phase two. And I think we've got really good biblical evidence to explain that and to validate that. Question is, have we got good biblical evidence to explain the other side? So what about the seed of the serpent, Babylon phase one and Babylon phase two? Have we got good biblical evidence to validate the one becoming the other? Well, I think we have, because if you come to the story of Babylon, phase one, becoming Babylon, phase two, let me show you a couple of interesting passages in that regard. First of all, if you come to Daniel chapter one, which obviously relates to Babylon, phase one, has an interesting comment to make right at the start of the prophecy, which takes us all the way back in time in mind. When Daniel chapter 1 verse 2 says, "And Yahweh gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. He brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God." Isn't that interesting? We're told that Nebuchadnezzar carried them into the land of Shinar. Where does that phrase come back from? That's Genesis chapter 10 and Genesis chapter 11. Nimrod builds a kingdom and a tower in the land of Shinar. By the way, and this is an aside to a brother who shall remain nameless who's wearing green, but could be interested in this comment. One of the reasons why biblically we know that the Babylonish religion must have spread abroad in the world is because of Genesis chapter 11. The seed of the serpent community gather together in Babylon. They build a tower, which was, of course, a religious temple. They celebrate their religious practices and belief. God comes down in the form of the Elohim. And what does God do? God says, "I'm going to scatter them from off this place." And so he confuses their tongues and sends them forth. So when the confusion of tongues occurred in Genesis chapter 11... guess what everybody from the seed of the serpent took with them when they left? And the answer is all the heritage of the Babylonish religious system in their different languages, and wherever they settled, they took it with them. That's why the original Babylonish system appears to have multiplied so successfully into other places, because actually Genesis 11 says that's exactly what happened. They all took it with them in their different tongues. So now, Daniel chapter 1 says that Nebuchadnezzar comes to a temple that's in the land of Shinar. You know what's significant about that? I believe that that temple, it's called here the house of his God, carried into the land of Shinar. I believe that that temple that Nebuchadnezzar came into was the very actual building that Nimrod first began. It was still there in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. Imagine that. Isn't that astonishing? Talk about a sweep back down through time, like a time warp. He walks into the very building that Nimrod had been associated with. That's astonishing. But what's interesting is this, is that temple is no longer. We'll come back to that in a minute. But if you come to, now, is it Zechariah chapter 5? Yeah. Zechariah chapter 5 says something interesting, because Zechariah 5 says, and I need just to give you the dates for this, but in Zechariah 5, you remember there's the prophecy of the wicked woman in the ephah that's taken forth by two storks, and it's a vision of not just a woman, But surprise, surprise, it's a vision of another house, a temple. And verse 10 of Zechariah 5 says, I said to the angel that talked with me, whither do these bear the ephah? And he said, to build her, that's what the revised version says, to build her an house in the land of Shinar, and she shall be established and set there upon her own base. So there's going to be another house, another temple built in the land of Shinar. But guess what? That land of Shinar in Zechariah 5 verse 11 is not in literal Babylon. And the reason why we know that is that this vision of the house of the woman in Shinar comes in approximately BC 510. And Babylon itself had fallen in BC 539, about 20 years before. Babylon's already fallen when this prophecy comes to Zechariah about another house, another building that would be built in the land of Shinar. Or it wasn't in Babylon itself that it was going to happen. It was somewhere else altogether. In fact, let me tell you what did happen. The Tower of Babel, which was known as a Temenenki, was going to last until BC 323. No, I'll come to that later, because in fact I'll show you that on another picture. So here we go. The temple in Shinar, answering to Babylon phase one, was to be destroyed. Yet afterwards there would be another temple in another Shinar, which indicates a Babylon phase two. Daniel 1 compared with Zechariah chapter 5. The term Babylon is going to be used by the apostles as a cipher for the city of Rome. Peter says, all they of Rome salute thee. But he doesn't say that, does he? He says, she of Babylon salutes. The ecclesia of Babylon. It was a secret code that the apostles used for the Roman system. And Revelation chapter 17 verse 5 talks about the Roman system as being Babylon the Great, the mystery mother of the whole system. And so the term Babylon is going to have a New Testament application to another system of things that's not actually Babylon of old, but it is still Babylon. It's Babylon phase 2. In fact, the very circumstances of the overthrow of Babylon phase 1 are going to be exactly matched by the prophecy of the overthrow of Babylon phase 2. If you go through Jeremiah 51, you'll find that all the terms that describe the overthrow of Babylon in ancient times is all matched by exactly the same language in Revelation chapter 18 describing the overthrow of mystical Babylon in the age to come. Word for word, phrase for phrase, passage for passage, idea for idea. The one is a mirror image of the other, but it's not the same Babylon. The one is modeled on the other, but one is Babylon phase one, overthrown in Old Testament times. The other is Babylon phase two, yet to be overthrown at the time of the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Oh yes, there's biblical evidence for these two phases of Babylon, you see. And lastly, Babylon phase 1 was destroyed for two reasons, we're told this in Jeremiah 51, for her corrupting doctrine and for her persecution of Israel. Her corrupting doctrine and her persecution of Israel. Do you know what Babylon phase 2 is destroyed for in the book of Revelation? For her corrupting doctrine and for her persecution of Israel. Except the Israel that she persecutes isn't called Israel. It's called the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, the saints. But they're the Israel phase 2 of the New Testament era, aren't they? And the very grounds of the judgment of Babylon phase 2 are identical to the reasons for which Babylon phase 1 was judged in Old Testament times. Oh yes, I think we've got a Babylon phase 1 and a Babylon phase 2, just the same as we've got an Israel phase 1 and an Israel phase 2. It's all biblically attested, you see. It's biblical evidence for this idea. We're not just postulating this. That's exactly what happens. And it makes good sense, doesn't it? If you just picture those two lines, they've got to carry on down through time, mustn't they? Because the battle's not over yet. The conflict's not resolved. The seed of the woman haven't won yet. And until they do, the seed of the serpent will continue to be hostile to them. That seed of the serpent community never changes, and in a sense, neither does the seed of the woman. So now, let me just give you that. That's a biblical analysis. Now let me give you the historical sequence of how that actually was outworked historically as far as Babylon phase 1 becoming Babylon phase 2. What was that year we said that in the year BC 333, a certain man entered into the city of Babylon, and his name, of course, was Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great actually arrived, and, you know, interestingly enough, one of the things he did was he said, let's rebuild the Temple of Nimrod. Let's rebuild the Tower of Babel. Let's rebuild Nebuchadnezzar's house of his God. It's actually one of Alexander's plans. So he said, let's do that. So mind you, he says, in order to do a really good job, what I'd like you to do is to take the whole piece, whole thing to pieces. So take it all apart, brick by brick, stone by stone. I want you to demolish and clear the site, and then we'll build this magnificent replacement tower. So they cleaned the site out. The only trouble is that right in the middle of that project, Alexander died. And they never rebuilt it again. So right now, as the satellite circles overhead, you can get a Google shot of the very site of Nimrod's tower. It's a blank piece, but you can see the markings where Etemenenki, the Tower of Babel, once stood on its ancient platform. Now it's a bare site. The intention was to rebuild it, but Alexander never managed to do it in the providence of God. Mind you, even though that temple was never rebuilt, Zechariah 5 says another house is going to grow up in Shinar, but the Shinar that it was thinking of was a different land of Shinar, you see. So in fact, what happened was that at the time that Alexander arrived, the last Babylonian high priest thought, I really need to get out of here. So he did. And he packed his bags, and he took with him the whole apparatus of the Babylonian system of worship. He literally packed it all up, and he went to the city of Pergamum, which is described in the book of Revelation as Satan's seat, where Satan dwells. Interesting description, isn't it, for a place where the last Babylonian high priest would go to? Satan's seat, where Satan dwells. And what happens was, 40 years later, the actual city of Babylon itself was destroyed because Seleucus Nicanor came along and said, I think I'll build a new city. He built one a few miles to the north. He said, now, where am I going to find some good building material for my new city? Which, surprise, surprise, he thought he might call Seleucia. He thought that would be a good name for a city, for some strange reason, seeing his name was Seleucus Nicanor. He said, how about we call it Seleucia? And everyone said, okay. And so he said, there's quite a good lot of rubble just down the road here. And so they demolished all the old buildings of Babylon, took all the stuff up the road and rebuilt the new city. And so old Babylon was abandoned. But 40 years before it was abandoned, it wasn't so much that Babylon had escaped, but the spirit of Babylon had escaped, and the seed of the serpent woman community had escaped. Sorry, the seed of the serpent community had escaped because the high priest had fled safely to another place, and he got to Pergamum. Now, Pergamum wasn't just a city, it was also a kingdom. The kingdom of Pergamum, of which the city of Pergamos or Pergamum was in fact the capital. And when he arrived there, he knocked on the door and he said to the king, he said, do you mind if I come and live here? I'm the high priest from Babylon. Hello, nice to meet you. And the king of Pergamum said, yes, that'd be great. Come and be here. And so he welcomed him in, and for a long time he stayed there. But there was a problem with the king of Pergamum, whose name was Attalus III, and his problem was he didn't have any sons and he didn't have any daughters. So finally he said, well, what am I going to do with my kingdom? And he said, well, I don't want to leave it to the Scythians. Actually, he didn't say that at all. I've just put that in, you know, for benefit. I've got to leave it to someone. How about I leave it to the Romans? They sound like pretty good chaps and pretty organized, civilized lot. So he did. He gave his whole kingdom with all of its wealth, all of its resources, all of its riches. And he said to the kingdom of Rome, look, I'm going to die without any heirs. Why don't you have my kingdom as a gift? Mind you, he says it comes with some another thing attached. You've got to take the Babylonian high priest with you. And all of his magic spells comes, you know, part of the deal. So the Romans said, it's fair enough. So he bequeathed the kingdom of Pergamum to the power of Rome. But at that moment of time, Rome inherited the whole system of Babylonish religion that had transferred from Babylon 200 years before, suddenly got to be taken over by the Romans in BC 133. In BC 63, Julius Caesar became what's called Pontifex Maximus. Now, Pontifex Maximus is the Latin phrase. You can actually see that all over Rome. All the buildings of Rome have got Pont Max, Pont Max, Pont Max all over them. All the old buildings, not just St. Peter's or St. John's. But the old Roman buildings, yes. It was a dynasty. Yeah, so the high priest always had a successor, but like the Gog, really. So yes, the Babylonian high priesthood just continued to succeed one leader after another. But their name, which was interesting, was Pontifex Maximus in the Babylonian phraseology. That's what the leader of the Babylonian mystery was called, Pontifex Maximus. That's simply the Latin wording of the same Babylonian expression. So Julius Caesar became the supreme pontiff of the Babylonian religion, and from that day, BC 63, every emperor until AD 376 bore the title Pontifex Maximus, which is the title that belongs to the leader of the Babylonian mysteries. If ever there was an evidence that the whole system had been transported to Rome, it's the fact that every Caesar called himself Pontifex Maximus, which wasn't a Latin title for the Caesars, it was the title for the leader of the Babylonish mysteries. That title was imported straight from Babylon. In AD 313, Constantine issued the Edict of Milan to establish Christianity and begin the introduction of Babylonian rituals and doctrines. So he succeeded in not so much advancing Christianity as paganizing Christianity. And finally, in the year 376, of which this is the reference, the Caesar of the day, said, the emperor of the day said, look, I don't really think that I want to be called Pontifex Maximus anymore. I'd like to relinquish the title. So the Roman Senate said, that's a bit tricky, because every emperor's had it since Julius Caesar. You don't want it anymore? The emperor said, no, I don't want it anymore. So the Roman Senate said, well, we'll have to give it to somebody. They said, oh, I know what we could do. Why don't we give it to the Bishop of Rome? The Roman Catholic Bishop of Rome. Would you like to be called Pontifex Maximus, the leader of the Babylonish mysteries? And the Bishop of Rome said, oh, that sounds jolly nice. Yes, I'd like that, thank you. And so the Bishop of Rome, alias the Pope, took the title Pontifex Maximus, the leader of the Babylonish mysteries, and assumed that as a title for himself. And every pope ever since has been called Pontifex Maximus, which proves that he leads the Babylonish mysteries, not just the Roman ones. Now, isn't that an astonishing outworking of how Babylon Phase 1 became Babylon Phase 2? It didn't die. It simply replanted itself in another place. And if the Bishop of Rome, the Pope of Rome, is Pontifex Maximus, leader of the Babylonian system of mysteries, guess where the house is where the woman dwells in the land of Shinar of Zechariah chapter 5? The answer is in the city of Rome, which is the very centre of Babylon Phase 2 in the New Testament era. And the seed of the serpent community carried on in that particular way. So why this is helpful is it just establishes that this ancient controversy that began in the days of Shem and Nimrod, the blue line versus the red line, in fact goes all the way back to the time of the Garden of Eden, but that conflict has in fact travelled all the way down through time, comes through the bump in the middle, right down to our time even now. The seed of the serpent community, the seed of the woman community. And why that's all significant is because that's all going to play itself out in how the story resolves at the end of time. And how Ezekiel 38 fits in as just one little part of that jigsaw puzzle at the end of the story. But how the story ends is our study on the framework of Bible prophecy tomorrow night, which will be the third part of the story. So I think we'll close at that point.